Okay, well, maybe we can start somewhat soon so we have more time at the end. So I was just going to give a quick intro, and then we can get going with our panel. So for anyone that's just joining the telecon that hasn't been on before, what we are basically is a group of us that are funded by the NASA Carbon Monitoring System Program. And so we've formed a working group for people that are working on projects having to do with atmospheric observations and modeling. And we've been having monthly telecons to hear about current projects, ones that are both funded by the Carbon Monitoring System Program and then some that are outside. And so we're very happy to have an interesting panel today talking about fossil fuel uncertainties. And so thanks, Tom, for organizing everyone, and thanks so much for the speakers for joining. So I've sent along three sets of slides for our panel members. Hopefully those will all come through okay. And we're going to go in the order of Bob first. So Bob from CDAC and Oak Ridge will talk about the CDAC fossil fuel emissions inventory. And then we'll have Salvi talking about FFDAS. So Salvi from Arizona State. And then finally we'll have Eric from Appalachian State talking about some comparisons between different inventories. And so we'll try to have about 10 minutes from each presenter, and then we'll have some discussion at the end. And we'll see how it goes. So I don't know if there's any other introduction you wanted to make, Tom, before we get started.
I'm good. Yeah, just go ahead. Thanks.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay, great. Yeah, so we can start then with Bob.
Okay. If people could open up, I think it's a PDF that Heather sent you all. And what I have sent you is just some summary slides of our work, and of course there's a lot of detail behind all those slides. I'd be glad to discuss that later with anybody who wants that detail. So moving on to the second slide. Last year we published a new global uncertainty assessment of the CDAC fossil fuel CO2 time series, and you can see that reference in the purple text there. And the approach that this paper took was that due to the lack of physical samples at the appropriate temporal and spatial scales, which is how we would have preferred to do our uncertainty assessment, we did our uncertainty assessment through three different but complementary ways.
Can you get louder, Bob?
Yes. Okay. Moving on to slide number three. The data that we used in this paper can all be shoved into this 3D box that you see on the screen there. Along the x-axis is the countries, which you could label by names or numbers. On the y-axis, the emission years from 1950 to 2010 is what we used in this study. And then on the z-axis, what we call inventory years, which is each new edition of the CDAC database as it comes out. And for this study, it was 1984 to 2012. And each new release of that CDAC database then would add a new face to this data cube that you see in front of you, displacing the old face towards the rear. And so the new releases of the data not only provide another year of data, but they also revise data from past years, and that will come into play a little bit later. In the lower right there, you can see three insets with some red on there. And those are the portions of this data cube that we used in the one-dimensional, 2D, and 3D assessments, which I'll talk about on the next slide. So let's move to slide number four. This is the 1D case, or what we could call a fuel-based assessment. And in this method, we take a look at the fossil fuel CO2 emitted as the product of the three terms that you see in the equation at the top of the slide there. This is a revisit of the Marlin and Roddy 1984 approach, which was the last substantial work in this area. And what we did in the paper last year was revise and add data for each term in that equation. And so in that chart, you'll see fossil fuel CO2 uncertainty in percent on the y-axis at the 2 sigma level, years on the x-axis. And the variation in those curves you see is due to different amounts of fuels being consumed in each year. And so as the fuel mix changes, so does the global uncertainty change. And the reason there's two curves on there is those three terms in that equation at the top of the chart there, you could cheat the data in those terms as either wholly dependent on each other or wholly independent on each other. And so we calculated those kind of bounding estimates. But the actual reality of the data is the mix of data of independent and dependent nature. And so the true uncertainty is somewhere in between those two curves, but we don't know what it is exactly. Moving on to slide number 5, this is the 2D case, or a country-based assessment, and it's based on the global total is equal to the sum of the country totals. And this is a new assessment for fossil fuel CO2 uncertainty. And the key to this was quantifying the qualitative error classes that we first presented in 1996 in our Global Biogeochemical Cycles mapping paper. And the variation in the two curves you see there is due to different countries emitting different amounts of fossil fuel CO2 annually. And so as the amounts from each country change, so does the global total change. And what you might notice at the end there is over the last decade or so is that our uncertainty is actually increasing with time. And that's because more emissions are coming from countries with less certain data collection and management practices. Moving on to the 6th slide there, the 3D case. This is a historical assessment. It's new at the global scale, though Christina Hamal did some work in this at the national scale for selected countries. And the approach that this assessment takes is taking a look at how is the data revised as new versions or inventory years are added to the database. And so what we see here is the effects of data revisions, missing data get reported, and in some cases, there's some methodology refinements over the last two decades. I didn't show you an absolute difference plot, and if we did, you'll see some. You would see that some of the values actually look quite large. But what I did show you here is a relative or a percent difference chart, and we see that those large in magnitude, absolute magnitude emissions changes actually become quite small in terms of a percent difference. And what we see on this chart here is 25 gray lines here, which each represent one individual emission year. And I just didn't label them individually just for clarity. But if we take a look at the curve that starts at zero and ends up going straight down right away, I'll explain to you what that means. And so at zero there is the first time that that year was reported. So let's say that was 1970, for example. And as that curve drops to a value between -2 and -4, that's how much that global total was revised in terms of a percent difference with the 1971 release of the data. And then as you follow it out, you see how it gets revised as more and more data and more years get added to the data series. And so what we do with this chart here is actually break up the data and kind of into two different regimes. The first regime is after 10 years from first publication. And what we see there is about a 1% growth in global total emissions with a standard deviation of about 1% at the 2 sigma level. And then the other regime is in that first 10 years, we see a little bit lower growth, about 0.75%, but a much larger standard deviation at the 2 sigma level of about 2.5%. So moving on to the next slide, what I've tried to do is throw all those assessments onto one chart here. And so on the y-axis there, we see the fossil fuel CO2 mass, and that red box is our best estimate of what the 2010 emission, global total emissions was. And then those lines surrounding it are the various 1D, 2D, and 3D assessments. So that's kind of messy, and our reviewers didn't like that. And so they pushed us very hard, and we finally agreed to greatly simplify everything there and try to get with the goal of having just one number for a global total fossil fuel CO2 uncertainty value. And that value at the 2 sigma level would be about 8.4%. So moving on to slide number 8, all I did here was plot our time series up of fossil fuel CO2 emissions in the black line there with that 8.4% greatly simplified uncertainty around that. And as you might have guessed, is the mass of uncertain emissions is increasing with time because the total emissions are increasing with time. So let's move on to slide 9. Here is something I thought that would be more applicable to what your group actually is doing and how this gets applied. And so to try to put this all into context, up in the upper left-hand corner in panel A there, I plotted the Global Carbon Project reported mass flux and reservoir stock changes on an annual basis. And so the sources to the atmosphere, namely fossil fuels and land use change, are balanced then by the sinks from the of atmospheric growth and the oceanic uptake, with the residual being accommodated by the terrestrial biosphere. If we move to the upper right, that's panel B. What I plotted there is the component mass equivalent to one sigma uncertainty. And the land use curve is hiding underneath the oceanic uptake curve, so it doesn't really show up. But depending on the case used, the fossil fuel ends that reporting period there in 2010, either with the smallest or the second largest mass uncertainty. Moving to the lower left, panel C, this is the same data as we saw in panel B, except it's divided by panel A, and so it's the percent uncertainty at the one sigma level. I didn't plot the terrestrial biosphere because its values are extremely large on this scale, and so if I would have put it on there, all those other lines would have overlapped with each other. But what we can see here in this case, in terms of percent uncertainty, fossil fuel starts off the reporting period as the smallest uncertain flux and ends the reporting period with an uncertainty on the order of the atmospheric growth rate uncertainty. Finally, the lower right, panel D, is the component uncertainty expressed as a fraction of the total carbon cycle flux, or you can think of it as panel B divided by the sum of the five components in panel A. And regardless of the fossil fuel CO2 uncertainty case used, fossil fuel CO2 begins the reporting period, you can see as the smallest flux, ends the reporting period either on an equivalent basis with the atmospheric growth rate or the second largest flux. So there's uncertainty about how uncertain is the fossil fuel CO2. In panel D there, again, the land use curve is directly underneath the oceanic uptake curve if you're looking for it. So let's move on to slide number 10. And here what I wanted to just quickly mention is what we're working on right now, and that is in the upper left here you can see the mass emission map that we've been producing since our 1996 Global Biogeochemical Cycle paper. And what that shows is fossil fuel CO2 emissions around the world at a 1 degree cell basis, in which Tom Oda is using it as the base for his ODIAC map and then tweaks that. What we're trying to work on right now, and we're close to finishing, is what's in the lower right, and that is in a similar map both in space and time, but the map variable now is the uncertainty in each grid cell. And as I said, we're close to finishing that. We're just not done with it right yet. Moving on to the next slide is a cartoon of what I think the basic problem is we're trying to address with these uncertainty maps. And what I've shown here is a hypothetical country with a hypothetical fossil fuel CO2 emissions. The exact same total magnitude of emissions is shown in each panel, only the spatial distribution has changed between the panels. The scales and arbitrary units. And the idea is that if we have an uncertainty estimate that exactly overlays those hypothetical mass emission maps, we'll be able to assess what the degree of difference is between those maps. This slide here focuses on spatial uncertainty, but there are also temporal uncertainty issues. So I think in terms of a gridded sense, a full uncertainty analysis would include issues related to the magnitude of emissions that I mentioned earlier in the talk, geography, as well as the distribution proxy within that geography. And Salvi and Eric will discuss those aspects more in detail following my talk. Moving on to the next slide, it's my final content slide. On the y-axis there, you'll see uncertainty at the 2 sigma level. On the x-axis, area. And here the focus is on spatial, but I think the same idea will carry across to temporal scales. And that is, as we go from global to national to the 1 degree cell level, you'll see that uncertainty is increasing. I've also plotted on there what the aerial extent of the urban domain is, but the vertical lines there are dashed because we really don't know what the uncertainty is at the urban scale yet. So the final slide there is just some conclusions and implications, and basically I just think that, you know, these assessments remind the community that fossil fuel CO2 emissions have a non-zero uncertainty associated with them, and this uncertainty is significant, either in isolation or in relation to other components of the global carbon cycle. And I'll stop there.
Great. Thanks so much, Bob. If there's any sort of quick clarification questions, and then we can move on to Salvi.
Bob, thank you very much. This is Mark Fisher. I'm curious whether perhaps Salvi or others will address this. I wonder about some disaggregation in between national and urban or 1 degree, for example, state level. Do you have any sense of where that would stand for the United States now?
That's a good question, Mark. I think we do have some ideas on it. I don't think anybody's published any of that yet.
Okay.
And some of it is just it's hard to get. What are you going to compare it to? It's easy to compare different maps against each other, but I don't think that really gets us where we want to go. And I think it ultimately comes back to is things that you are pushing and the group in Boulder is pushing, is we probably need to end up going to 14C or some other measure to really get a handle on this. But we're nowhere near the data density we need to really do 14C measurements for an uncertainty analysis at this point.
Thank you for starting to address it. I guess for states which have independent or quasi-independent from U.S. EPA emission control measures, i.e. California, I would be very interested, and maybe somebody's already done this, to compare your 1 degree maps with the state totals. And I wonder whether that's in process or is something somebody ought to be thinking about.
I think Eric Marlin will address that in part. I've seen some of the stuff that they've worked on, and I'm not sure he exactly answers your question, but it'll be closer to than what I could give you right now.
All right, very good. Let's just continue. Thanks.
Yep.
Okay, great. Let's move on to Salvi.
Hi, everybody. This is Salvi. I do have actually an answer for the question that was just mentioned. Maybe I can say that one first before I start. For FFDAS, we actually have done this, and it's in the paper. We did this comparison of the state total using EPA, I guess, that we did, and compared this to the state total emissions. And that's in the FFDAS paper that was released in 2015. And we did that for United States, for China, and for Australia. At the state level, so I go for the talk now. So I'm going to talk about FFDAS uncertainties, and for FFDAS we have, hopefully everybody knows about. I'm assuming people know about FFDAS. So FFDAS is a fossil fuel data assimilation system. So we calculate fossil fuel emissions data assimilation model, and we have developed a data assimilation model and calculated fossil fuel CO2 emissions in that model. And I'm going to talk about the uncertainties. The paper is there. I forgot to put the name of the paper, but I can give it to anybody who is interested. But we have prior uncertainties on our observations, and we also have posterior uncertainties. Because it's a data assimilation model, we can give it prior and get a posterior uncertainty. So for prior uncertainties, we have for IEA national emissions that we are using. The IEA, of course, doesn't have uncertainties. We used MACNIC 2011 harmonized data set. So there are five different reports of national emissions, and these five reports are different they have categorical differences and parameters differences, and MACNIC harmonized these five data sets so they can be comparable. And we use that harmonized data set, and we calculate the span of the five estimates for 26 countries. MACNIC did this only for 26 countries. And we did this for that 26 countries, and we calculate the percentage span value for, we use that one as the uncertainty. And this, for the rest of the countries, we use categorization that was developed by RAPAC 2010. RAPAC categorizes the whole world into eight regions, and we use those eight regions, and we estimated uncertainty for using these 26 countries, and we assigned uncertainties to other countries. I have also in this slide, I have provided some of these percentage span values in case if you're interested to take a look at it later. Slide number three, we have also power plant point sources that go into FFDAS, and for that also we have calculated uncertainties. So power plants we have built upon for power plant emissions, we have built upon CARMA data set. And we have improved that data set by improving the locations to some extent, and also by we regenerated a multivariate regression model, and we estimated emissions again, and also estimated uncertainties for each power plant. And then we have night lights that go into the model also, and as an observation. And night light was given to us a new night light data set. Previous FFDAS 2010 used a night light data set that was saturated at the urban core centers. So Peter Rayner and they developed, and in the Rayner 2010, they developed a technique to analytical technique to take care of the the saturation issue. But in the new version of FFDAS, no INGDC, they provided us a new set of night light data set that is not saturated, and they call that radiance calibrated. And this is only available for 6 years, and we used the linear interpolation technique, and we created a whole time series from 1997 to 2010. And then, so night light errors come from different sources. First is converting from the raw 6-bit detector, quantizing the 6-bit detector value to counts, and then from counts to radiances. And then they actually know people, NGDC people, they do a lot of other pre-processing on this data set, and in order to create annual global night light radiance calibrated data set, and they provide that in 30 arc second. And we also aggregated that to 0.1 degree, and some uncertainty is also associated with this aggregation. So we settled then on prior uncertainty, or prior uncertainty for night light as 0.5 plus 1 cent of night light value for each pixel. And for the interpolated night light years, we increased that uncertainty by 25%. We have also actually generated a couple of years of future years of 2011 and 2012 estimates. This we have not released it, but we have generated that. But and it's of course it has a lot of flaws, and I mean it's a lot of uncertainty associated with that. It's a very simple thing we did, but for that, for those 2 years, we inflated uncertainty by 30%. And then, so this was the uncertainties for night light and prior uncertainties, and now I'm going to talk about the posterior uncertainties. To calculate posterior uncertainties, we actually are doing a Monte Carlo, using a Monte Carlo technique, which we generate 10, we calculate 10 Monte Carlo realizations of the posterior fluxes at 0.1 degree resolution, and then we calculate the standard deviations, and that's what we provide as uncertainties. But this important point here is that if somebody wants to use this uncertainty, and if they need to aggregate this data set, they should not aggregate the uncertainties. They should ask us for the realizations, and we give them the realizations, and they aggregate the realizations, and they regenerate the uncertainties. And next, slide number 6 is showing the map of the uncertainties for 2003, and this is expressed as percentage of standard deviation, and you can take a look at it, and if you have any questions, we're happy to answer. And so next
slide. Toby, this is Tom. Yeah. Probably you want to explain what kind of data estimation you did in your FFDAS for people who are not familiar with your FFDAS.
Sorry, can you say that again?
So you're saying the prior and the posterior, so you did data simulation. So probably you want to explain what kind of data simulation you did in your FFDAS.
Data simulation in FFDAS?
Jim, you did up to date, right?
Data keys meaning.
Didn't quite understand your question, Tom.
So you did a parameter optimization in the FFDAS, right?
Yes.
So. Probably, you want to explain what kind of the optimization you did in FFDAS for people who don't know about FFDAS.
Okay, I can probably quickly explain that FFDAS system, how it works. FFDAS basically has two sectors right now. So we distribute national emissions into using night light and population and power plant point sources. So night light and population are used to distribute using the data assimilation optimization process is used to distribute national emissions for what we call other sector, which includes industrial, residential, commercial, and transportation. And we use power plant point sources to distribute emissions from power plant, from the electricity generation sector. And so the system uses prior uncertainties and optimizes this distribution using population and night light, and which is actually following the Kaya identity model, which is the base of the FFDAS, which is the base model that FFDAS uses. Which this information is provided in the paper, of course. And so for the that is we basically use the prior uncertainty and the national emissions and these data sets and the Kaya identity, and we distribute this emissions into pixels and create the global grid map. And so this is the posterior uncertainty. So the previous version of FFDAS used a different technique to calculate posterior uncertainty, the whole covariance matrices and everything they calculated. But in this version, because we have point source power plants, we can't really do that. So we use the Monte Carlo technique to calculate posterior uncertainties. We calculate 10 Monte Carlo realizations of the posterior fluxes at 0.1 degree resolution, and we calculate these posterior uncertainties from that 10 realizations, basically calculating the standard deviations. And I don't know if that answers your question, Tom.
Thanks.
Okay, sure.
That was a comment.
So, slide number 7, we are, so like I said, FFDAS has two sectors, other sector that and electricity sector. So the uncertainties in the other sector is coming from a combination of night lights and national emissions, and are positively correlated within one country. But that's not how it works for point-wise, for the power plant point sources. The uncertainties of the power plant point sources are not reduced by the assimilation system as much. But power plant emissions are constrained by national emissions. So in order to evaluate whether our choice of uncertainties for power plants was reasonable or not, and if the model is working properly, and also to see how much posterior emission estimates are deviating from the prior, we also calculated RMSE for power plant point sources, and our RMSE values are between 0.4 to 0.7, which is reasonable for the years, for the whole time series, and this was between 0.4 to 0.7. And so we, by that, we think that our the choice of the power plant uncertainties were reasonable. And the last slide is number 8, which just to mention that overall, evaluating the model performance, we want that the statistics of the differences between model output and the observations agree with the distributions that we assumed in the beginning in the statistical formulation, which is normally distributed and independent. So we check this overall thing by checking cost function. In a consistent optimization, the final cost function should be approximately equal to the number of observations. And if the value is higher, it would tell us that the fit to the data and prior value is worse than what we would expect from the uncertainties. And if it is lower, then in that case, we would increase uncertainties. But if it is lower, then it would tell us that the input uncertainties are larger than necessary. And so that was basically just about the uncertainty calculations. I'm sorry that I couldn't give, didn't have time to actually explain the model better. I would be happy to actually give a talk on just the model itself, FFS, and how it works. And, so this was the talk. And also I want to emphasize on what Bob mentioned in the last slide in his conclusion. I don't have conclusion, but that would be also my conclusion, that these assessments, that the fossil fuel CO2 emissions are non-zero. The uncertainties are non-zero, and they're insignificant, and they should be considered in our models. So thank you so much. And if there is any question, I'll be happy to answer.
Do we have any quick questions for Salvi?
Salvi, this is Mark. Thank you very much for the excellent description of your uncertainty analysis. If I could turn back to the comment I think you made at the very regarding the state level comparison. I'm sorry, I am not familiar with the 2015 paper you described, and I wonder, would you be so kind as to distribute it to the folks on the mailing list, or on the email list for today's meeting?
Certainly, sure.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
I apologize if I don't know about something obvious.
No, I should have written the name of the paper actually in the beginning. I forgot about that. Sorry.
Okay. Well, let's go to Eric, and then
I have one other quick question, I guess. In your, you know, very nice plot of posterior uncertainties, do you have readily available a sum of those uncertainties for either nations or states, and in ratio to the total emissions, do you get numbers that are sort of similar to what Bob mentioned before, sort of 10% on the annual timescale, or is it likely to be quite different?
We would like to compare with Bob's results. That is something I guess we talked about in the NICC meeting.
Okay, so for the future, very good.
Yes.
Okay.
This is Ralph. I have a question about split between fossil fuels and biofuels. How is that being handled?
We are not doing any biofuels in FFS. This is only CO2 emissions from fossil fuel.
And Ralph, the same at CEDIAC. We don't consider biofuels.
Right, but what about when it's in the gasoline mix and so forth?
As far as I understand, I think the IEA emissions that we are using is not really having that one mixed with the data set that they provide. So whatever is bio, we are excluding.
Go ahead, Salvi, sorry.
Sorry, whatever is bio, we are excluding from this analysis.
In the UN database, which has relationships to the IEA, there is separate data on biofuel consumption by country.
Right.
We don't consider that, though, in the fossil fuel CO2 databases. Biofuels aren't fossil fuels.
Yes, that's what
Ralph,
I meant, sorry. Yes.
Yeah, so, Ralph, in answer to your question, if a gallon of gasoline is 80% fossil fuel and 20% biofuels, just for simplicity, our fossil fuel CO2 inventory is only reporting on the 80% of that gallon that's actually fossil fuel, and the CO2 from the biofuels portion is missing from the inventory.
Right.
Okay, and that's a good answer. I suppose one might imagine a need for tracking the biofuel that's distributed like fossil fuel at some other point in this process.
Yeah, that would be very interesting, sure.
That could be done. It's outside the scope of what we're doing now.
Yeah, and it might become more important in the future. At least many of us hope so.
That's right, and depending on the country, it could have a much bigger effect than in other countries. That's correct.
Okay, so yeah, let's move on to Eric.
Okay, I have put a large green number on the slide so I can keep track of which slide I'm on a little easier. Hopefully that helps you too. And I'm going to kind of zoom through these slides because I have 21 slides, but not as much to say about each one. So this should go relatively quickly. On the first slide, this is just a plot, a series of plots of five of the different data sets, all plotted at 1 degree resolution. So the top four have been converted to 1 degree resolution so that we can compare to CDAC. And the essence of this is that they're different enough that it's important to understand why they're different and where that difference is coming from. And a nice question would be, if you were to add in the uncertainties, do they actually overlap? I think the answer is yes, because the uncertainties are very large right now, but it's an interesting question. On the second slide, we did a grid cell by grid cell comparison of the different data sets and found that most of them start to coalesce and agree with each other on a grid by grid level somewhere around the 1 to 2 degree range. Currently, CDAC is a little bit off. These are from the others, and these are questions to figure out what's causing the differences and where this plays in. On slide three, we started looking at the components of uncertainty. If we're going to break down uncertainty into pieces, try to understand each of the pieces, and then build back up, we start, as Bob suggested, with the country total uncertainties, and then we break down all of the pieces. And the pieces are directly a measured emissions, like we would get out of large power plants or large industrial sources, although the large industrial sources, the data set is only available through the EPA in the U.S. CARMA globally does not have the large industrial sources, just the power plants. And then any spatial and magnitude uncertainty for estimated or modeled emissions. And then one that we've spent a lot of time struggling with, first spatial and magnitude uncertainty in measured proxies, such as night lights or the land scan population data. And then the last one is how well does that proxy reflect emissions? So if you want to understand how well does population density or night lights reflect emissions, then we need to find some estimate for how to approximate, how good of a proxy it is. The next slide, slide four, takes a step over to the large point sources and suggests the magnitude of the role of large point sources. This is the percent of total CO2 emissions from just power plants, not counting other industrial sources. And when the total number of power plants are creating upwards of close to 50% of the total emissions, this is a clear indication that we really needed to get the power plants right in order to get anything reasonable out of this. And if we go to slide five, this suggests just for the U.S. Just how important these power plants are. The first graph on the left is the percentage of sources by size class, which basically suggests there are very few power plants that are the giant monsters. But if you look at which ones produce the emissions, those same very few power plants produce a huge number of emissions. And on slide six, we see sort of a summation of that, is that a third of all of the emissions from everything in the U.S. come from only 311 sites. So if you miss where those 311 sites are, or if you miss how much emissions are coming from those 311 sites, then that's uncertainty going into a third of the U.S. emissions. And the seventh slide kind of...
I'm sorry, one quick question.
Yeah.
All emissions, do you mean all power plant emissions or like fossil fuel emissions?
Fossil fuel emissions.
Okay, thank you.
So one third of all fossil fuel emissions. On slide seven, we looked at the top 50 grid cells or sorry, the yeah, the top 50 large point source grid cells. So which, from just large point sources, from just power plants, where were the largest one-by-one grid cells, and what was the corresponding value of each of the data sets? And what you can see is that of those top 50, and these are 50 that we searched through Google Earth to actually verify their locations, of those 50, none of the data sets has a value for every single one of those power plants that's greater than or equal to the value of the power plant itself, which suggests that there are some potential alignment issues, possibly in how we converted and displayed them. But in the next slide or two, I'll suggest what another possible cause of this is. But this suggests the problem. And the problem, then, is that the locations of the power plants in slide 8 is not as accurate as we would like to think it is. On the left-hand side, there's a map showing 7 different power plants in the EPA grid, the EPA data set, and in the CARMA data set. Those are the orange and the red, all allocated to the exact same location to 4 decimal places accuracy, latitude, and longitude. Clearly, there aren't 7 in exactly the same spot. On the right-hand side, this shows a power plant that's been allocated to the center of a city when it is actually located out next to a large water source 23 kilometers away. And so this disparity, we need to figure out. The problem partly is that the CARMA and the eGrid, the EPA data sets, were really repurposing. The original intent of them was not for spatial accuracy, it was for required accounting. And they use typically different naming conventions. They have default allocations. These are all self-reported, so if a power plant doesn't report their proper location, the default allocation for eGrid is to place it in the centroid of the county that it's reported in. And some of them get it reported to centroids of counties, some possibly to downtown corporate offices, not always the latitude-longitude location of the actual stack. And so we need to be careful about the spatial uncertainty of these power plants, even though we would like to think that they're completely accurate. So on slide 9, this shows an analysis we did of the EPA eGrid data set that has been improved since. They had an old version posted online at the time that we were doing this, and it does an analysis of 500 random points of what the actual location is compared to the reported location, along with some extra statistics. And this gets a little bit at Mark's question about summing up per state. There's a large number of power plants that are located in water, which also means that there's a large number of power plants located very close to state borders. And what this means is that if you have, say, a one-by-one grid cell level, this is about 10 kilometers, then it's very likely that a grid cell spans two states. And if a power plant is located in that border region, it's not clear in an automated way which state the power plant gets allocated to if it's placed in that border region. I think that one possible method is to say wherever the centroid of the grid cell is, it gets allocated to the state that centroid falls in, but that's not necessarily where the power plants are. So we'd like to at least preliminarily suggest that if the power plants are placed in states in a sort of a layered format where when you add them together, they're in the country format, but if you pull them apart, they're allocated to a state, that you could resolve those issues. Things that are not large power plants are not going to be as much of an issue because the distributions are smoother. but getting a large power plant in the wrong state because it happens to lie on one of these borders, which if you think of the Ohio River forms the borders of a huge number of states, and so this is not an uncommon occurrence. Anyway, so we got startled by this 500 random points, with a lot of them being incorrect. So we looked at the largest one. So on the next slide, we looked at the top 81 emitters, and I forget what it was, a cutoff having to do with the amount of emissions, not the fact that it was 81. But we initially thought maybe the biggest ones are correct, and it's the small ones that weren't being paid attention to. But it turns out that these largest 81 weren't any better. And if we keep in mind, we're using the U.S. sort of as a test bed for the world, so we can correct these 81, we can correct the 500, but correcting the 50,000 for the world is a bit cumbersome. We run out of undergraduates really quickly. So on slide 11, this highlights the reason that these misalignments are going to happen regardless of how accurate we are. This is a plant in South Africa where the actual stacks, the main offices of the plant, and the street address are all in different grid cells. And so even if you get within a few yards of the location of the actual stack, inevitably there's going to be a couple power plants that are misplaced in the wrong grid cell, unless you GPS the actual top of the stack. But then again, if you have multiple stacks and they're not all functioning at the same time, there are going to be mistakes made, so we need to allow for this uncertainty. In slide 12, this presents very briefly. All my percents got changed to ands, but we used a Monte Carlo method to estimate the likely locations of the power plants, and on slide 13, we have the mean, or roughly, more or less, this is the expected values in the upper left, and in the lower right, an estimate of the uncertainty. The ones where the entire county is colored are ones where the power plant was arbitrarily allocated to the centroid of the county, implying that we really don't know where they are within that county. And the ones with smaller colored areas are ones that are not in the centroid, and we're using the statistics we found in the sample of 500 to place and characterize their uncertainty. If we go to slide 14, we looked at comparisons between FFDAS and ODIAC in the upper right, and the banding that we see in looking at the correlation suggests, although we're not positive, that at low light levels there may be some resolution issues at the very lowest light levels. As you allocate to larger and larger grid sizes, they agree better and better phenomenally well. And in the lower left, we looked at transepts through large cities, and this is the issue that Salvi was talking about earlier with correcting the nightlights issues with the saturation in the middle. My suspicion is that this is an old slide for FFDAS or old data that may be corrected by now. But it also brings up the question whether if there's light saturation in the center of cities, perhaps there's emissions saturation as well, and we don't know. If in the center of large cities, if the proxy starts to fail. So that's sort of the next question. And so we talked to Bob back, and we said, let's see if we can come up with an overall uncertainty for CDAC. And he was kind enough to subtract off the large point sources, and in slide 15, the lower right is allocating everything except the large point sources according to his current methodology and putting the point sources back in. And then we wanted to understand the uncertainties. Slide 16 shows how much the variability in the per capita state emissions reduces by taking out the large point sources. And if we back estimate variation in the per capita state emissions to what it ought to be by summing up the states from the grid level, we looked at the average number of grid cells per state and back calculated with the square root to take the variation by state backward to the variation by cell to estimate what the variation per cell ought to be, and used that to estimate the probable error or uncertainty in the assumption that per capita emissions directly reflects emissions. And so using that variation per state, we get an estimate, at least, of what the variation and what then the standard deviation should be at the grid level. Slide 18, we did something very simple for LandScan because they don't have an estimate of uncertainty yet. I emailed the leader of the group, and he said, this is really tough. We don't know how to do it, but we're working on it. And so we did some very simple approximations. And then if we skip over to slide 20, this is putting all of the pieces together, even though the pieces are not perfect yet, to get an overall uncertainty for this special case of CDAC that we worked with Bob to get. And finally, on slide 21, this is basically just a list of questions that come up. Where do we target uncertainty to try to reduce it? What is the low-hanging fruit in terms of trying to reduce the uncertainty that at this point is fairly big?
Yeah,
and that's it.
So, Eric, then on the previous slide, is that's a percentage uncertainty?
Actually, that is that is magnitude uncertainty.
So that's mass units, right?
That's mass units. That's actually, I believe it's tons CO2 equivalent, multiplied by some large factor. It's on a log scale, so that's probably 10 to the 20th.
I have a quick question. This is Catherine McCain. I have a question about the eGrid. I'm not familiar with that database and what its primary purpose is, but I was wondering if you also checked against the Greenhouse Gas Reporting Program from the EPA database.
eGrid is only power plants, and the Greenhouse Gas Reporting includes all large point sources, including industrial sources. We initially used eGrid because it was more comparable, or supposed to be more comparable, to KARMA, and KARMA only does the power plants. If we wanted a more accurate reflection of the U.S. by itself, I think we would want to go to the Greenhouse Gas Reporting. They ought to be the same for power plants, but the Greenhouse Gas Reporting data should also include things that are not power plants, like refineries and large chemical plants.
Within a regulatory framework, what is the purpose of eGrid from the EPA standpoint?
That I don't know. Do you know? Yeah, I don't know.
I suspect they all have to, there are some emission standards, and eGrid is probably used to ensure that they are following that, the operators are. Because they measure NOx.
Yeah, right. It's every day.
It's an EPA requirement that the plants report. Some of them, most of the bigger plants have constant monitors, and some of the smaller ones calculate and estimate emissions based on fuel consumption. The Greenhouse Gas Reporting Program is voluntary. The eGrid system is required reporting.
So, yeah, it's open for any questions or further discussion. I was going to say there wasn't much in the presentations about temporal variations in emissions. I was wondering if anyone wanted to touch on that a little bit.
I can say that FFDAS, on FFDAS, we have it, we have created this for annual for 1997 to 2010 annually, but we also provide this at the hourly scale, monthly and hourly scale also.
And what's your do you have uncertainty estimates with that as well, or do you have any?
No uncertainty estimates with that.
Temporally, it's very difficult. You know, things like Karma and EGRID usually are annual averages, and if you want to break things down into monthly or weekly or daily, there's no information at that scale. And that's important if you're thinking about large point sources, for example, because they get shut down periodically for maintenance, and that doesn't mean the emissions necessarily go to zero, but they go to a much lower level. And what happens is in the electrical grid is other power plants then ramp up their emissions to produce the electricity that we all want. And so there's these displacements spatially to take care of these temporal variations. And right now, none of the large databases capture that temporal variation at all.
Right.
This is David Baker. I have a question about the longer scales. Does the 8.5% uncertainty go down when one goes to, say, decadal scales, or is it still pretty high like that?
It's pretty constant, actually, David, over the last 50 years, that 8.5% at the global scale. There's a little actual uptick in the last few years, but the reviewers didn't want to hear about that uptick in the last few years. They wanted one number. And so over the last 50, or since 1950, so the last 60 years, 8.5% at the global scale is remarkably consistent over time.
But I guess what I'm getting at is there some of that 8% due to not knowing exactly when between adjacent years the emissions happened, and does that reduce when you just look at longer time spans, when you average up over, say, a decade?
I'm not sure I'm following your question. That was done on a year-by-year analysis, but I don't think that's answering the question that you're asking, so I'm not quite sure what the fine distinction is that you're trying to pull in.
What I'm trying to say is, say, you know, 1% of it is uncertain between, you know, 2005 and 2006, and it's just not, you don't know. I'm wondering how much of that is you not knowing exactly what year the emission was emitted in versus the fact that it was emitted, if that makes sense. In other words, the placement in time of the emissions versus...
So you're saying, like, are some of December's fuel usages actually leaked over into January of the next year? Is that what you're getting
at? Yeah. Is that at all important?
No, like, I think that's pretty minor, actually, over time, yeah. That's not a significant... for the CDAC data set, that's not a significant concern at the present time.
Okay. Thank you.
There is some question with the time of emissions for fossil fuel products that don't emit immediately. So if you think of production of lubricants, it's important not to assume that they get emitted into the atmosphere immediately, that there's an expected lifetime that may be a couple of years' worth. And so basing things off of production and assuming that they are immediately emitted ignores the idea or the fact that they may be accumulating in a stock. And therefore, there may be a growing amount of some stock that isn't being emitted. This is particularly important for biofuels, and for wood products. But there are some fossil fuel products, such as lubricants and asphalt, that start to accumulate.
I guess that's a question. I mean, how much of when you come up with these national numbers, do you assume that all the carbon in the fuel goes up immediately into the atmosphere is included in the annual total, or is there a lag that you factor in? And is there, in fact, some that doesn't even go into the total emissions at all, but just remains in some other form?
No, that's a good question, and you're getting into some of the finer details of the calculations. And we actually do two sets of calculations. One is based off production data, which was what Eric alluded to earlier, and we think those are the most accurate numbers, and that's what we use for the global totals. And the price you pay for that, more accuracy, is you lose national specificity as to where the fuel is actually consumed. And so for the national totals, what we end up doing is going to data that's more accurate at the national level, but it has more uncertainty associated with it. And so if you were to sum up all the countries around the world that we have and look at that total, it's less than what we report as the global total. And there's this long-lived products that Eric mentioned, things like asphalt and lubricants, is one of the components that's missing from those two, between those two. But it's not the only thing. There's really four things that play into it. And so it depends on the scale of your question as to what's the best data set to use.
Hey, Bob, how do you deal with things like aircraft emissions?
That's a good question. It depends on if the aircraft are used in domestic service or international service. If it's domestic service, we include it in the national total. If it's international service, it goes into a category called bunker fuels, which is a United Nations definition for fuels used for international commerce. And those don't get attributed to any one nation by international convention. And that's another big piece of the difference between if you do global totals by production values or consumption values. The production values has those bunker fuels in it. The national values do not have the bunker fuels associated in it.
So a follow-up question for other who do spatiotemporal, how do you distribute, do you actually do some work on redistributing CO2 emissions, or is it a second-order term?
That's another good question, and at CDAC we don't worry about it, but in the ODAC version, which CMS is using, Tom goes through and puts in international aircraft and international shipping. I don't think he does anything on the domestic front, though, for domestic aircraft.
Yeah, Bob, that's right. I don't have domestic, but are just distributed international bunker emission using FluxEater. In my case, Edgar, SipTrack, and AL2K air emission inventory.
Yeah. And I think the next evolution along those lines, Dubé, if this is where your question is going, is right now all emissions in ODAC and CDAC, and I think in FF-DAS also, are assumed to be emitted at the surface. But obviously aircraft are not at the surface. And with a little bit of work, I think we could put in a third dimension there to get the altitude correct on those emissions. But I don't think anybody has done that to date.
Yeah.
Actually, this is Junjie. Actually, in JUICECAM, like atmosphere model, transport model, we use aircraft emissions that, like in through 3D aircraft emissions. I think that's done by Ray Nasser.
Okay.
Yes, Ray has looked into that, and that's based off of the work out of Illinois, and I forget the PI's name on it off the top of my head. But I don't.
Don Wibbles?
What was that?
Don Wibbles?
Yes, Don's work. Yes, Don Wibbles' work. But I don't think that's been universally incorporated for global work. It's been done for a lot of local and regional type of studies. And likewise, you could extend that if we're going to do large point sources as separate targets of opportunity by putting in stack heights. And that would help with some boundary layer issues that models are having.
Well, we've run a little bit over an hour. Anyone else wanting to ask any questions? Well, then I'll just wrap up and thank you all so much again for presenting and for a really interesting discussion. And then we'll follow up maybe some questions by email And we'd be happy to have you participate in future telecons as well. So thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.